Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, I'm Michael Steele. So good to be with you again as we sort of trek our way towards Thanksgiving and the holidays and the end of the year. And there's one thing that's interesting about the end of the year that people generally don't pay attention to, but a lot of business owners do. That's when you got to, you know, meet that nut. You got to figure out, okay, do we turn a profit this year? You all hear about the Black Friday. Well, that's what Black Friday is all about for a lot of the retail industry. This is the day where they make their money, believe it or not. After everything else is said and done, this is where they make the money on this day. And it's true for all kinds of businesses. As you get to the end of the year, you get an assessment of how you're doing, how you're set up to go into next year. And that is particularly true for small and minority-owned businesses who are a lot of times working at the margins, who are, you know, doing okay, but, hey, if I had a little bit of help, I'd do a little bit better. Well, we got someone on the program today who knows a lot about that, and as we kind of take an assessment of where business is in this country, and particularly where small and minority business, I couldn't think anyone better to bring on to have this conversation. She's Adrienne Trimble. She's the president and CEO of the National Minority Supplier Development Council. Prior to joining the council, Ms. Trimble was general manager, diversity and inclusion at Toyota Motor North America. So she's been in the room, folks. She was responsible for leading and executing diversity and inclusion strategies and initiatives across Toyota's North American operations. And she's brought those skills along with many others to her work now at the Supplier Development Council. Ms. Trimble, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. And I'm really thrilled to be here with you. As you know, this is a key topic of discussion as we think about ways that our economy is dependent upon the small businesses that are really fueling our economy. So this is something that's near and dear to me as we talk about the ways we can increase access to those opportunities.
Yeah, well, that's what it's all about. It's all about creating access to opportunities. It's one of the things I focused on when I was Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, looking at our minority business enterprise system that the government had had in place for such a long, long time, and trying to figure out how does it work? What is it doing? Who's benefiting from it? And to be rather frank about it, what I discovered was that majority-owned contractors, white contractors largely, were the biggest beneficiaries because they worked from a very, very small pool of minority firms. They would use them to access the bigger pool of dollars and contracts. But when you really peel back that particular curtain, they weren't getting a couple of things. One, a fair share of the success, profits, the dollars, to any opportunity to really grow and to position themselves to become the major contractor on government and other types of contracts. And three, to the point that you were just referencing, there was ultimately limited access to other opportunities because they were either pegged or defined a particular way. What does the council do, the National Minority Supplier Development Council do in this space? What is the organization about, and what are some of the things you're emphasizing that touch on those points?
Absolutely. So in essence, that's exactly why NMSDC exists. Our whole mission is to connect minority business owners with those opportunities within corporate supply chains. We have over 1,400 corporations that are represented in our network, and that includes national and local members throughout the country, as well as in We have global access as well. In addition, we have over 12,000 certified minority businesses that we are working with on a daily basis through our 23 affiliate councils throughout the country to help connect, make those connections to corporate America. We know that in the corporate supply chain, there are many opportunities for different types of goods and services, and we want to ensure that our businesses are positioned to bring those solutions to the table that will help with that innovation, creativity, and driving cost reductions within their supply chain.
So when you put all of that in space, how does a black-owned business actually wind up profiting from some of those strategic partnerships with corporate America? Do you guys create the platforms? Do you educate majority-owned companies how to work with and deal with minority firms? What's the spectrum of things that that you guys are doing that, let's say, me as a small minority-owned firm would see and realize some benefit?
Absolutely. One of the things I think is really important for folks to know is that our primary focus is getting that access. And to do that, we have to work very closely with corporate America so that they understand exactly who is available in this space, who are the pool of suppliers that's ready to do business with them. So we do have a focus on educating and increasing awareness for corporate America, as well as positioning our minority businesses for those opportunities through different type of educational sessions, development sessions. We all know that access to capital is a major issue. So how do we make sure that these firms are positioned to grow and scale and so that they can be ready to meet the needs of corporate America? We just completed our biggest event of the year, our annual conference in Atlanta, Georgia, where we had over 6,000 people there ready to do business with each other, from corporations to minority businesses, large, small. It's amazing how when you put people in the right platform, in the right area for those connections to happen, how those business connections can come to fruition.
So there was a piece that was out recently in August that talked about how black-owned businesses can profit from these strategic relationships with corporate America. And in the piece by Derek Dingell, he noted that, you know, unlike a lot of other businesses, and certainly unlike any other era in American business, how much companies are now earmarking, investing in you know, these sort of programs, which tend to be pretty high profile, as a matter of fact, that provide sort of the procurement and business development opportunities that entrepreneurs need to be successful. And they cited AT&T, for example, which had invested something like $67 billion in this idea of, you know, in DirecTV, which was sort of creating this space for minority firms to kind of play. How does that ultimately wind up working out? What does corporate America really think of the minority business owner? Is it someone they really want to play with, or is it someone they think they or feel they have to play with?
You know, I think as we look at the changing demographics of this country, I think it's becoming more critical for folks to understand that we know that small business, the growth in this country is going to come from small businesses. That's where the data is telling us, the statistics show us that that's where the growth for the economy will be in the future. If we look at the changing demographics, that population is going to be increasingly more brown people, African-Americans, Latinos especially. So if we know that that's the growing segment, I think corporate America is now starting to understand that this is who's going to be our consumer in the future as well. And when you think about the whole issue of why this is so important, it's really about creating discretionary and disposable income in communities that are traditionally underserved and underrepresented.
Right.
Because that in turn will help fuel the economic growth in those communities, creates jobs in those communities, and helps those communities become a lot more self-sustaining. So I think that corporate America is starting to see that this is a bigger picture. In fact, we're moving beyond just talking about this as supplier diversity, and it really is about economic inclusion for all.
Well, and I think that's a very, very good point. And I just want to correct myself. I want to clarify what I said. AT&T made us a purchased DirecTV for $67 billion. Then spent another $104 billion to purchase Time Warner, and their commitment has been to invest $3 billion with black suppliers across the United States by next year. So you do have that kind of effort to make a direct connect, a direct investment in these companies. But I guess the question that I have ultimately is, does it work? And where are you seeing the proof in the pudding? Because it's one thing to say we want to make these investments. There's another thing when you actually do it. And what exactly are you investing in? The kinds of suppliers, for example, how much is it changing the market? You're absolutely right. The country demographically is changing. More and more minority-owned businesses are expanding and growing in the marketplace. And it, in my estimation, will be the last piece of the transformation of America from what it has been, sort of a European white-centric sort of economy and politics, et cetera, to something that's going to be very, very different, much more diverse, where you're going to have not just one Bob Johnson or one Oprah Winfrey. You're going to have 35, 40, 50, 100, 1,000 of these individuals who, and we already are pretty much there. A lot of them aren't known, but you can see that space, Ms. Trimble, where these entrepreneurs really can change that dynamic. And it starts with some of these investments, for sure. So do you actually see these things being realized short term to sort of lay down the tracks for longer term opportunities?
Absolutely. We conducted an economic impact study in 2018 mm-hmm. on just the businesses that are certified through NMSDC. And what we found in just that small number of, again, 12,000 of our certified companies is that in 2018 alone, there were over 500,000 jobs created by those firms in the community just in that year. And over $400 billion in revenues were generated from those firms. And I think that is the greater impact that people have to understand, that that's just a small portion of it. There are over 8 million entrepreneurs of color in this country. We're talking about just a small sample of those that have been able to generate those types of results that we can track and report the statistics and the data on. So we can get to a position where we are doing this more holistically. I think that people will then understand why this is so important that we make these investments, because that is how communities become much more sustainable and have the necessary resources to create the jobs and create the discretionary and disposable income in those communities that will drive our economy.
So you've got the private sector, you know, I referenced AT&T and Time Warner and all these folks that are trying to play in that space and are doing well, as you noted. But then there's the government side, and you have over the past year, the Trump administration has made a pretty big deal about their opportunity zones and the impact that they'll have. I know right here in Maryland, Governor Hogan has been working with developing opportunity zones in parts of Baltimore. And there is hope and skepticism about what these opportunity zones actually will do. The people who are hopeful are seeing this as a way to draw investments into neglected and underserved communities across America, regardless of zip code, and put an asterisk there because that's part of the problem, regardless of zip codes, which means, as some cases have cited, that these opportunity zones wind up in certain zip codes that really don't need opportunity because they already have it. They're not the poorest of the poor. They're not the most underserved community, but developers and other interests have a financial connection there that they can derive the benefit from these opportunity zones. So there you have this sort of yin and yang kind of feel about what these things are. What's your assessment? What is the council's assessment of these opportunity zones? Where do you see them working? And what ultimately do you think the impact could be for minority communities and minority businesses?
I started having conversations with the White House administration, particularly the Minority Business Development Agency and Henry Childs, the national director, about this well over a year ago, because we do see opportunity zones as a way to spur the economic development in those communities that have been traditionally underserved and left out of the economic prosperity cycle. I think that in order for Opportunity Zones to really be the tool that it's been established to be, there has to be greater participation by minority businesses that represent those communities. And not downstream, not at the end of the supply chain, but at the very beginning. And that's why at NMSDC, we've actually created a partnership for Opportunity Zones where we are working very closely with two NFL legends who are very well known in business, mm-hmm. Emmett Smith and Chris Carter. They've created Gold Jacket LLC. And what they are going to do, they are already a real estate and facilities management company, but they are going to be helping us reach out to corporate America to understand where those true investment opportunities are. How do we make sure that we're positioning minority businesses to be a part of that discussion, a part of that development, so that those dollars flow back into the community the way they are intended to be? So to your point, that we don't have folks who are just coming in, making their money, then taking their money back out of those communities, but that those dollars are staying right there. So we're really excited about the possibilities of what Opportunity Zones can do and what they can be if it's done correctly.
Well, and it's the if they're done correctly part that is of a particular interest. In fact, I know in the Baltimore situation, where the program allows investors to use profits from other investments to reinvest in real estate or businesses in these designated zones, there are upside benefits to them. Obviously, they can defer and reduce their capital gains and on their initial profits and things like that. So they see it as a win-win. But there are still some folks out there, particularly minority communities, that see this nothing more than a handout for the rich, and there is no real windfall for those poorer areas where, supporters have come in and tried to pitch, hey, we really like to do this. How, in your conversations with the White House and your efforts across the board in, not just in, hardened urban areas like a Baltimore, but even in some rural areas that, are underserved, for example, what are you hearing? How do you see overcoming those particular types of reservations when you encounter them?
So we are being very deliberate about which projects we are targeting for Opportunity Zone development. And for us, because we want to ensure, again, that we have minority businesses participating in a meaningful way, the first area that we're tapping into for us is around HBCUs. We know that a lot of historically Black-owned colleges are really in need of updates, real estate development projects, things that are going to help continue to attract and sustain student populations in those communities. And many of them are located in Opportunity Zone areas. So we're starting in areas that we know that we can make an impact, that we can make a difference, and we can actually make sure, again, that those dollars are managed, controlled by minority business owners from the beginning to the end of those projects. So I think that for us, instead of looking at this at a very wide area, let's try to target where we think we can make the biggest impact. And that's why we chose HBCUs to start with our project.
Well, I love the HBCU connection. I really do. I think they should be a huge part of any economic development plan, particularly any plan that's looking at creating these types of opportunity zones. They just should be because of not just of their historic relationship to the community, but the fact that you do have a concentration of intellectual power, human capital, and other benefits that come with having these institutions be a part of any of these plans. Ms. Trimble, we're going to take a quick break. Got some sponsors now. They really kind of like coming on the program because folks are doing that wonderful thing you guys download, and I love you for it, and so do our sponsors. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to put two issues on the table. The first touches on what we were just talking about, Ms. Trimble, and that is gentrification and how that plays into these opportunity zones scenarios, as well as what it means for a minority business potentially. And then, of course, what are some of the things that companies get wrong when it comes to diversity? We'll take a quick break. We'll be coming back with a little bit more with Adrian Tremble, President and CEO of the National Minority Supplier Development Council. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back. We're going to pick up our conversation with Adrian Tremble, President and CEO of NMSDC. That's the National Minority Supplier Development Council. Ms. Tremble, we were just talking about the impact of how these diversity programs and opportunity programs are really kind of shaping and reshaping communities. And one of the things that really concerns me, having grown up in Washington, D.C., and having been Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, and watched neighborhoods change literally before my eyes, is this idea of gentrification and the impact that it ultimately has. What does the council's approach, what has the council's approach been to this particular conundrum? Because on the one hand, it's great. You know, you're bringing revitalization to a community. You're infusing it with cash and opportunities and businesses and neighborhoods and all this stuff. But let's be honest, that only happens when white folks show up. It ain't happening in a community where that is stabilized as a minority community. So what is the game plan and how do you guys look at that? Is it a problem? Maybe I'm just overreacting to it, but I tend to be a little bit more sensitive about these things, but what's your thinking and thoughts about that?
No, and I agree with you. I don't think that you're overreacting, but I do believe this is why, from an NMSDC perspective, we decided to control our own destiny. Frankly speaking, we had a number of large real estate development companies approach us about working together in opportunity zones. But for us, it had to be about the impact for our minority business owners and how they could have a meaningful role in this project and in this process. And so for us, that's what we worked with Emmett Smith and Chris Carter and David Coswell to create our own firm so that we can control the projects that we work on, the participation of minority businesses, control how those dollars are invested, and making sure that, again, it's tied to real outcomes for our communities. The only way that we do that is if we have a seat at the table and we are driving that conversation. So that's why I think we have to be much more involved. And if this works well with this one project, this one firm that we're working with, then we can replicate this and bring more firms into the fold so they have a bigger impact.
So how does the council, I mean, this is, for me, this is kind of the nub of this, because a lot of it has to do with if you've got a neighborhood that is on the edge and it was once a well-established community and due to a whole lot of demographic and organic changes in the neighborhood, drugs, crime, all of that stuff, all these things that kind of push up against these older established neighborhoods that, you know, eventually lead to them becoming, quote, run down, et cetera. What are we doing to get those minority companies, businesses, the business owners who decide to stay to be supported and to help grow, to have them be the anchor of revitalizing that community? I mean, one of the things that irritates me to no end is that, and it's a catch 22, I'll admit it right up front, that people in the black community, for example, will drive literally past black owned businesses to go to a mall, to go to a white area for shopping. And then they're going to sit there and complain and moan and groan when the black owned business goes, I can't keep my doors open, I'm leaving. So how do we deal with that catch 22 in the first instance, and what incentives can be put in place to have those companies become the anchor, as opposed to looking to bring in a Whole Foods so forth, and then, you know, next thing you know, Becky's walking her dog down the street.
I think that what we have to do a better job of is increasing the awareness of the businesses that exist in our communities. I'm actually working on a project with the Minority Business Development Agency to do just that, to have a campaign or a platform that really highlights these businesses within our communities and finding ways that we can better support them. So we know that we're about to go into the biggest shopping season of the year.
Right.
I've heard things about it's Entrepreneurs Month, it's Small Business Month, it's let's support our women-owned businesses. We've heard all of those type of platforms out there, but there's no one talking about doing businesses with minority firms,
right,
and minority companies.
That's
our role now. So we're working very closely with the Minority Business Development Agency to make sure that our businesses are not being left out of this conversation, and they are being represented, and we are driving traffic to them and giving them that awareness and that platform to be able to talk about the services that they provide so that we know that these services exist right here in our own communities.
All right. Well, I'm going to hold you to it.
It
is such an essential part of it. It was one of my frustrations. I tried to tackle it head on when I was in office through our program, various programs. If you haven't had a chance to look at some of the stuff that we put in place in Maryland, I would highly recommend it because it was at that time very innovative. It pressed up against banks. It pressed up against established contractors. And it reordered the landscape, or at least attempted to reorder the landscape a bit around that idea that you just mentioned. And that is, okay, not just saying, oh, you know, we want to do business with minority businesses, but actually doing business with them and making them a part of what's going on at the community level, the county level, the state level, and even nationally, because a lot of these companies have bandwidth to be at the table as a Maryland company playing in Louisiana or Kentucky or California, or even another aspect of, I was trying to open this up internationally. We've done a number of things at that time in Africa, in China, Israel. So black businesses are no different than white businesses, except the owner happens to be black. And
absolutely,
just as confident, capable, and love profit just like the white boys do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you'd be surprised, folks. You would actually be surprised, folks, how hard that is to translate in reality, what I just said, because it is one of the reasons why American businesses still don't play on the African continent the way China, France, India, and other nations do, because of this old, I don't know, colonial view of the capabilities of African Americans, and in the case of the African continent, Africans, to actually do business the way they do business. But we'll save that for a different conversation, because I don't want to get Ms. Trimble in any more trouble than I probably already have.
You're biting my tongue on some things, because you're right. Yes.
So before I let you slide out of here, I do want to get your thoughts on this whole diversity piece. You've worked in this space. You helped Toyota sort of pick itself up and move forward in this space, particularly dealing with not just minority suppliers, but minority owners of dealerships, et cetera. What are some of the things that companies and individuals out there, those of us who just kind of follow this stuff, get wrong about diversity and what it is and what it isn't when it comes to what a company does?
And I'll tell you what I think most people don't realize is that it has to be a strategy that encompasses the entire enterprise of a company. For instance, when you talk about diversity and inclusion, it's not just about workforce representation and getting people to the right levels within the organization, but it's how you develop those folks and how do you create a culture where they can be engaged, they can be productive, they can actually contribute to the bottom line. It goes back to what you just said. people are people at the end of the day, and they just want they have these careers because they want to contribute. They want to feel that they're doing meaningful work. That's what inclusion is geared to do, is to make sure that we're positioning people and setting them up for success in these organizations, regardless of their race, gender, whatever that may be. That's how you make sure that you're getting the right people to the table. But secondly, I think that there are some firms out there that really do this well because they do it from an enterprise perspective. I look at firms like AT&T, when they talk about their commitments and how it's not just about the workforce side, not just about suppliers, but it is a holistic approach that they take to ensure that they are driving inclusion through every aspect of the business. And I think that when you really get there, it's not a standalone initiative. It's just how you operate. And it becomes a part of the company's culture and the company's DNA. And that's when you know that you've really been able to integrate diversity and inclusion throughout your organization.
So how much does, I guess, what is the role, for example, like recruitment? How does that work? You know, a lot of companies they'll just figure diversity is reflected in recruitment. That and they kind of stop there. Should they go beyond that? I mean, is it
absolutely? Yeah, that's just a starting point. That's just getting people into the door. But what happens once they get in the door? How are they treated? Are they given the same access to the key projects that get them the visibility as their non-white peers or their male peers, whatever that diversity looks like at organization? It's really making sure that once you get those folks in, that there's an intentional strategy to allow them to succeed and get the same opportunities that everyone else gets. We know that there are those, I call them the secret clubs that exist within corporate America, where when you have people that run in certain social circles and live in certain neighborhoods, and if you aren't a part of those circles, then you are excluded from some of the informal coaching, development, and opportunity discussions that take place outside the corporate doors. So to me, the recruitment piece is just one. That's just getting them in. It's what happens to those folks after they get into the organization. How are they progressing? Are they on key assignments? Do they get the visibility? Do they get to participate in meaningful meetings? Those are things that make the difference once you get the folks in the door.
How does this current political environment that we're in, and I've deliberately stayed away from politics per se in this conversation because I really wanted to focus on what you're doing and your leadership over at NMSDC. But these companies do operate in a highly charged political environment in which ideas and concepts around affirmative action, for example, and other institutional efforts to level the playing field are disparaged and not really acknowledged. In other words, there's a sort of the zero-sum attitude out there that if you're sitting in here promoting black businesses, that means you're going to kill a white business. If you're promoting a black woman within your company, that means that a white female or a white male is going to lose their opportunity in that company. How do you deal with that crazy? Because that's what it is.
And that's just what it is.
That's what it is.
And that's where you have to have just a real conversation, and you can't be afraid to have that discussion. It's not about a win-lose. It's about a win-win.
Right.
And how do we position it so that people understand? And you know, we have to be real honest here. And I remember reading this some time ago, that people who are in positions of power and influence don't just readily give that up.
No.
And we know that they're not going to readily give that up. So you have to create an environment where they don't feel as threatened by those folks who have been traditionally left out of a lot of those opportunities, that they're now in that opportunity, and it's a benefit to them. It's a benefit to the company. It's a benefit to the organization. How do we make sure that they know that this is being done to help advance the company's objectives and not as a threat to them personally? So that's why diversity and inclusion has to be tailored in a way that it gets to the culture of the company and the leadership expectations, so that you're creating an ecosystem where everyone can fully participate. Because at the end of the day, it's about making money, and it's about driving profits and shareholder returns for these organizations. And you have to make sure that you have the best people regardless at the table to do that.
Yeah, and that's when this truism is never more true. It's not about black or white. It's about green, baby.
And it's about green, yeah.
And if you can enhance my color of green, then We're rolling in the right direction. Adrian Trimble, thank you so much for taking time to come on and talk about the good and important work you're doing to expand the platform, the playground, the landscape for minority businesses across the country as president and CEO of the National Minority Supplier Development Council. And we really appreciate your thoughts and insights and look forward to inviting you back as things going, and certainly if there are projects and programs that you guys are specifically involved in, let me know, because I'd be happy to highlight them and let the folks who play on my playground get a sense of what's going on in your part of the world as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the invitation, and stay tuned because we'll be coming back to you with some upcoming initiatives for 2020.
That sounds like a plan. All right, folks, that does it for this week. You know we're going to come back because there's a whole lot of crazy going on in the world. We're going to talk about it. We're going to cover it, get you up to date on it. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts on. I'm Michael Steele. Thanks again for listening. Catch y'all next time.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.